I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. You need a dictionary or encyclopedia when you go to the supermarket these days. You want to buy a dozen eggs and you have a lot of choices. Cage-free, range-free, free-roaming, certified organic, farm-fresh, omega-3, pasteurized. Whole Foods has a new labeling system they're calling Responsibly Grown. It's based on the supplier's practices protecting air, soil, water, and human health. Fruits and vegetables are now called good, bad, better, or best. And don't get me started on the word natural. Who even knows what that means? Well, today on Radio Times, deconstructing food labels, organic, gluten-free, GMO-free, fair trade, and much, much more. Joining us is Mark Lang. He's a professor of food marketing in the Hobbs School of Business at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. And Mark Lang, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. If you have any questions to join the conversation, you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, talking about food labels or food labeling. Where did this all come from? I mean, all the fact that you can now go into the supermarket and you look at a can or you look at a package and there's something there that tells you something about what it is that you're buying. Where did these labels come from?
Well, I agree with you, Marty. There are dozens, if not dozens and dozens, of different claims emerging on labels today. And they are, if you study consumer behavior, they're what are called credence attributes. And credence attributes are characteristics of products that influence our evaluation and choice of them, but that we can't evaluate on our own. So if a product is 20% larger than another one, we can judge that ourselves.
You can see it.
You can see it. You can judge it at the shelf. But a credence attribute like natural, like you brought up just a moment ago, we can't judge that ourselves. So it has to be communicated to us on the package when we're evaluating the product. And there's been a lot of changes with that happening. And they can communicate to us on their website, in advertisements, at signs on the shelf, like the Whole Foods program, or on the package. And the package is the most impactful form of communication at the point of sale where most decisions are made. So that's where all these claims are coming from. There are improvements and changes to products that manufacturers and retailers think we are seeking, and they're trying to communicate to us that these improvements are present in the product.
What you're saying is this is really largely consumer-driven, and that food companies are responding to consumers that want things that are organic or local or perhaps non-GMO?
Mm-hmm. It is. And what's interesting as we list the various attributes or characteristics here is that they are all manifestations of one larger underlying theme, which I think prevents a nice organizing framework for the discussion. And it's that the American population is reacting to an over-industrialization of the food system that happened all the way back in the 60s and hasn't really changed until about a decade ago. And the reaction is that customers are redefining what food quality means. And they're going back to a simpler, cleaner, more wholesome system for growing and processing food. And they're even looking for greater connection and understanding of where and who food comes from. And it leads to things like fewer, higher quality ingredients, less mass-produced, natural, whole products, interesting varieties and types and recipes, more transparency, and even things like social, local, sustainable, and seasonal products are all characteristics of consumers wanting to have a better quality, and this is how they're defining it.
And this is good news, I would think. I mean, the fact if we want more transparency, we want more information, mm-hmm. I guess the question is, are we getting it from the people that produce our food?
Well, yes, and there's two questions with that one. Are the traits and characteristics that are being discussed, are they valid? Are they really real issues, substantial issues that have a bearing in the quality or the safety of the food, or are they faddish, superficial things that are the thought of the moment that are going to be gone in 2 years, or are they real? And the other one is what we're being offered and being told on packages true?
Yes.
So is natural actually important, and is a natural product natural? Is a gluten-free product, is gluten-free really an important characteristic, and is the product really gluten-free? Two dimensions to that.
Well, what does natural mean? Or is it in the eye of the beholder? Or is there any objective? If you're seeing something and it says natural, should we be suspicious? Does it mean anything?
Well, this is one of my favorite topics because I personally believe in natural being a valid change in products. But unfortunately, in the business of marketing and food marketing, natural can be used and abused by anyone who wants to use it now in most cases. So it's not defined very well and it's not regulated by the USDA. So it can appear in many different places. But the idea of natural is a valid idea. And I would define natural as having no artificial or synthetic preservatives, mm-hmm. additives, colors, sweeteners, or flavorings. All the artificial things shouldn't be there. And it should be free from foreign ingredients that are added to facilitate its manufacture or to give it more weight or something. And it should be free from chemically processed ingredients like perhaps high fructose corn syrup or other things like that.
But that's your definition. Mm-hmm. But if we're in the supermarket, is that the definition of some food company when they say natural?
It is.
I think, fair enough.
In the absence of an organizing framework like organic that's regulated, in the absence of that, I think the shopper has to consider who is claiming natural and the nature of the product. So I think some products will never be really natural, okay. like I just described.
Right.
But there are brands, I think, and it starts to make the role of branding more important in this discussion. There are companies, I think, that are working really hard to prepare natural products, and you have to decide for yourself, but I think there's a lot of them we can trust. And they have that kind of reputation. It's in their brand equity. It's what they stand for. It's in their mission as a company. And if they're saying a certain ice cream or cereal bar is made with natural ingredients, we as consumers can judge for ourselves, but I think that many of them are.
But the point you said, it's that organic has to abide by certain rules and regulations. And this is important, I guess, in differentiating between organic and natural.
It is, absolutely. So organic is supported by a federal law that required that the USDA establish standards and a verification program for certified organic products. And it has translated into a government agency that's responsible for it. So it's the organic program. And they are responsible for setting standards, setting auditing agencies, and requiring companies to follow certain rules if they're going to use the word organic. And there's three different ways you can use organic. And they have to be audited and meet all those requirements. And then they're certified and allowed to use the word organic on their package.
And what are the three ways you can use the word organic?
You can be 100% organic. And that's the USDA 100% organic seal. It's a button. It's a green button you might see on the front panel of a package. Or you can be at least 95% organic, and you can use the seal again. Or you can be made with organic ingredients, and you have to be more than 70% organic ingredient. Oh. So you might have a flavored milk that is mostly organic because all of the milk is organic, but some of the other ingredients aren't. So there's three levels to participate in, and I think that was a great idea because it allowed a lot more products to come into the system early on and start to build an organic business.
Many people want to buy locally. I know that's one of the consumer demands, I think, probably because of CSAs or just feeling like you want to support your local farmers. What I read, though, that according to the federal government, local is within 400 miles. According to Whole Foods, local is within a seven-hour drive. And from Walmart's perspective, local is grown in the same state. So do we have different measurements of what local is, or do those sort of, when in the final analysis, sort of all end up at the same place?
Your listing of those definitions are exactly what I put in an article just recently.
Well, maybe I was quoting you.
An academic article, yes. And then a Progressive Grocer article. There's a lot of discrepancies in the definition of local, but if you look at it from an industry standpoint, they're almost entirely based on distance. And that originated from the idea of produce food miles. How far did produce travel before it was in your store in front of you? And what amount of fuel was used? What was the impact on the environment in terms of CO2 emissions and that? So it was an environmental issue. But we did a survey at the university just a couple of years ago, and we found that the consumer doesn't define local by distance. They do, but it's much less important than the idea of small, family-owned, independent businesses that are near their home and part of their community. That's much more important right. than distance. And that is what triggered the idea that this is a reaction to over-industrialization of the food system. People want to feel like the where their food and who their food is coming from is someone they might be able to relate to, who has some kind of connection to themselves or their community, and they're not necessarily a large faceless corporation in another state or country.
But does local mean organic or not necessarily?
It doesn't. Organic and local are two different things. So some local products are organic and some organic products are local, but they're two different sets of criteria. But back to my earlier comment, they're both parts of the new definition of quality. They both go back to that root cause, that underlying idea.
Costco apparently sells more organic food than Whole Foods. Wow. I mean, this is a growing trend, obviously.
It's well established when it gets to that stage. It's the interesting thing with Costco is any business that they get seriously into, they begin to dominate because of their store network and the volume that they can sell. But I think that's a troubling proposition for Whole Foods, who built their whole brand and their whole business on organic. Buying an organic product, you don't have to go to Whole Foods anymore. So it doesn't serve as a point of difference for them anymore. So I think that they have to ask themselves, why else do people come to Whole Foods if I can get organic at Costco or Super Fresh or Walmart even?
Is that why Whole Foods is opening – I think it's sort of built around their label 365, opening these smaller, perhaps slightly less expensive stores built around their label?
I think that they're building those stores to try and be more accessible to a larger part of the population who might like to shop at Whole Foods, but they can't or won't pay the price that's
whole
required.
Paycheck,
their whole
that?
Paycheck is their nickname for a while now. So I think that, but it's not so much trying to address the organic issue and that being a successful point of difference for them. It's market penetration. I think that at 400 stores across the United States, 430 maybe right now, across the United States, they may very well be reaching market saturation or maximum penetration for their concept across the country. Their leadership announces that they plan to have 1,200 stores across the United States. And personally, as someone who studies the marketplace, mm-hmm. I don't think there's enough market to support that many stores. So I think their idea or their strategy is if we're going to penetrate more of the market, we have to change what we're offering in some way. And this smaller, friendlier, less expensive offering may allow us to get into neighborhoods and other areas where we couldn't support a full-scale Whole Foods store.
And we're up on a break here. It sounds like they want to take on Trader Joe's.
I really think so.
Okay. And perhaps we should pick up on that after this very short break. We are talking about food labels in this hour of Radio Times. Our guest is Mark Lang. He's a professor of food marketing at the Hobbs School of Business. That's at St. Joseph's University here in Philadelphia. We are going to take a very short break. Much more to talk about. And we want to talk with you. I see comments coming in. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Deconstructing food labels in this hour of Radio Time. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about the confusion over food labels these days. Words like organic, I think we know kind of what that means, but also natural, gluten-free, GMO-free, fair trade. You go to the egg department in the supermarket, and that can be also confusing as well. Helping us sort all this out is Mark Lang, a professor of food marketing at the Hobbs School of Business at St. Joseph's University. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Now, Whole Foods has also introduced these, three criteria for their food: good, better, and best. As you said, they have been known for selling organic fruits and veggies, but now they're introducing something else. What's going on with Whole Foods?
I think that Whole Foods is following their mission of trying to educate the population on the issues behind production and processing of foods and moving us towards a cleaner, healthier food system. And they've spent a long time, decades, working on building the idea of organic. And I think that they believe that there are a lot of products that aren't organic but are making great strides towards a better food system that could and should be recognized. And they're trying to do that in their stores.
Well, I'm looking at some of the criteria, good, better, and best. Under better, besides 16 farm practices to protect air, soil, water, and human health, farm worker health and safety, protecting rivers, lakes, and oceans, advanced soil health, water, and energy conservation. Under the best, protecting bees and butterflies. I mean, these are, it's an interesting, I guess, addition to figuring out what is the impact of what I buy? Mm-hmm. What's the impact on someone who actually harvested this crop that I'm eating?
Well, I think that these are ideas that are real issues that have to do with health that results from our diet. It has to do with the quality of the foods we're consuming. And it also has to do with experience. And that's a very big factor in the food business, and it's getting a lot of attention right now in research, is that we don't just buy food for rational, logical reasons. We experience the world through food. We express our culture. We celebrate through food. And we want a elevated and better food experience, and that's really what Whole Foods has built themselves on. So it starts to be, these ideas are part of a lifestyle. They're not just about buying food. It's how I choose to live in society and within the environment, and how I express that through the products I buy and I consume. So when we start talking about butterflies and
bees,
there's a pretty high order issues around the food system. They're real issues, by the way. We have come more than once near a colony collapse of bees, which would shut down a large part of our whole food system, by the way. But it's the idea of constantly introducing and trying to educate us on what are the issues behind where and who our food comes from, and we should be trying as a society to be improving that.
I read some organic farmers complaining, saying, you know, this just sort of muddies the waters, or I have to fill out these complicated forms from Whole Foods in order to meet their criteria. I don't know whether this is just trying to sort of get used to this, but a bit of a pushback from the organic farmers.
I think the pushback from organic farmers is really coming from the fact that this can represent a form of competition for organic. They've made significant investments in time and energy in changing their operations to meet the organic standards. They've spent a lot of money to do that as well. Mm-hmm. They've paid for audits and certifications. And here comes another standard that might be easier to achieve, that might be seen as equal to consumers, and it's eroding or devaluing their investment in organic as a business.
Oh,
so I think that's really their concern.
Because they're having to share the marketplace, right, with Walmart and Costco.
Right.
And other just regular supermarkets as well.
And they, after their investment, they don't want to see the demand for organic, certified organic, erode. And when natural products are more and more accepted, you don't need to buy organic if you believe a natural product meets most of your requirements. In one of our studies, we called natural the poor man's organic. You can achieve
it feels that way sometimes.
Yeah, you can achieve a lot of the benefits without paying for everything else. And the interesting thing is that organic is a three-part system. It has to do with the actual food and materials and how it's produced. It has to do with sustainability and the impact on the environment, and it has to do with humane treatment of animals. When we survey customers, we find that the overriding reason people buy organic is for cleaner, higher quality food. They're much less concerned in terms of their shopping behavior about sustainability and humane treatment of animals, which are the basis of organic. So natural, when it's done correctly, delivers on a cleaner, better quality food.
Let's talk about gluten-free. And, you know, it seems like every package now says that it's gluten-free. I think I was reading somewhere that there's a brand of salt that says it's gluten-free, although I don't think you need gluten to have anything to do with salt. What's behind this?
This is one of my pet peeves,
is
gluten-free,
it?
By the way. It's what I would call a fad. This is where I would make a distinction between a trend and a fad. A trend is a long-term shift or change in how consumers think, feel, and act regarding food. They take years to develop and mature, and they have lasting impact for decades, and they're based on substantive issues that are anchored in demographics, culture, and technology. They're real changes in the system. Fads are loosely based on facts and science. They benefit some small stakeholder or special interest group usually. They pop up very quickly. They're not really based on strong bases, and they go away. But
they
are
anecdotal. I mean, I know people that, you know, they don't have celiac disease, mm-hmm. but they swear that gluten-free food makes them feel better.
Well, the term that's being used, I think, is gluten sensitivity or gluten intolerance. But the population that actually has a diagnosable gluten issue is 1% or 2% of the population. And when you look at surveys that are being – some industry surveys, they're touting as much as 20 to 30% of the population intending to buy gluten-free products. And I just think that as has happened in the past, the industry overreacts to a fad and it fuels itself. And I just saw recently, I think it was gluten-free Lucky Charms. And I thought, there it is. Okay, it's tipped right there. I think you should be a lot more worried about sugar. Sure. And sugar in processing and sugar in foods, and then the average person should be than they are about gluten.
You were interviewed in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, and I think you mentioned a billboard here in Philadelphia, a store promoting gluten-free furniture.
All our furniture is gluten-free. I thought that was very clever.
That actually is very clever. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And we're talking about food labels in this hour of Radio Times. Mark Lang is our guest. He's a professor of food marketing at the Hobbs School of Business, and that's at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. We've been talking about organic and natural and gluten-free and other things that you read on labels. And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to get to our callers, but let me just do the eggs, which was part of my introduction. And I have to say, when I go to the dairy part of the supermarket, I just scratch my head about, you know, cage-free and range-free and free-roaming and all the labels that we see there. Can you bring some clarity to that?
I'd say they are the food industry trying to respond to the consumer's new definition of quality, mm-hmm. which is pulling back from a food system that has become over-industrialized. And it's become over-industrialized for real reasons. Consumers demand more and more convenience. They demand lower and lower prices. Wall Street demands that companies have better and better profit and growth. It requires cost cutting and efficiencies in manufacturing. And over decades, as we've done that, foods and food production may have gone in some directions where it doesn't make sense to us. And yeah. Poultry is one of those where if you see large-scale poultry, just Google that, large-scale poultry operations, we've ended up doing some things in those facilities that we're questioning now. And it was okay for a long time because we wanted convenience and low price. But our new mindset is that we can do better than that. And the manufacturers hear that, and they're making those changes mm-hmm. in the areas where those things play out. So if animals are cooped up in a facility too much, the answer is cage-free or pasture-free or grass-fed, is letting them go back to a more natural growing system, which is very much like organic and some of the other things we discussed.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. Looks like we have Don from Princeton joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Don. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
All right. Hey, I had a question. Whole Foods has all these different certifications that they have. You know, their humane treatment of animals, their whole trade system, and now their newest system for how food is raised. Who is watching them? I mean, they're self-certified, so how do we know it's not just, you know, marketing BS?
Well, and that's one of the questions, Mark Lang, right? How can we trust a company that's, in a sense, doing their own self-certification?
It is up to the consumer population to make that assessment and decide on that, except in areas where the federal government has decided that they will step in and define things and set standards and regulations, and that's what happened with organic. These things evolve over time. So a brand like Whole Foods could identify humane treatment and start to claim humane treatment as a credence attribute. And it starts to become more and more of an issue. And then the government might step in. They might be asked to step in. Companies can ask the USDA to help clarify and define things and set up certifications. But until that happens, it's messy out there. It's trust. And that's where brands come in. And do you trust that brand?
We have an email from Beverly. She says, I support sustainable and organic, but not Whole Foods after the owner so vehemently opposed the Affordable Care Act, calling it fascist. Humane treatment of animals is not more important than care for humans. Which is an interesting – I've heard that before, mm-hmm. and he certainly did criticize the Affordable Care Act. And I think for some people, they said, that's it. I'm not going to go to Whole Foods. Talking about these interesting criteria that people use to make their food shopping decisions.
Well, this gets messy again because a very mission-oriented brand like Whole Foods that has done a lot to influence the food system, they become part of society. And they become part of how we think about who we are and how we impact society and the environment. And we start to expect things from them that are beyond them being a company. And this is exactly what that is. And leaders of companies like that are often outspoken. That's how they got there. And they start to step on things like that.
And people then make decisions based on what they say or don't say. Let's talk about GMO. And I read that Chipotle not buying GMO-produced products for their food. And this, I think, is often confusing. But again, at the same time, you go into a store and you see non-GMO. How should we understand that?
Well, GMO has just recently, I was describing how a company can ask the USDA to set up certification. That just recently happened. So the USDA has the process verified program, and you can now claim non-GMO on your package if you follow the rules that they establish. So that is an actual validated claim now. So you can, it's there for you, and you'll start to see that. There's a lot of debate as to whether or not that should be mandatory or voluntary, and right now it's voluntary. This GMO is another very messy issue. We don't really know if GMOs are bad for us or if they're not, if they're bad for the biosystem or if they're not. But there's a group of businesses, and they're the organic business. They see a GMO as a way to make a new reason to buy organic, because organic is one of the rules, or non-GMO. So it very much benefits them to frame GMO as a bad thing, to identify products that are GMO, to make organic products another reason why to buy them. And I think that this has risen very quickly in the media and in society, just in a matter of a few years. I think that there are organizations behind the scenes here that are trying to make GMO an issue, and it's working. And that's, and we're on the other side of the shelf looking at it, trying to decide, is this a good thing or a bad thing? The good thing with GMOs, and there's very few people who are willing to stick their neck out and say it's a good thing, is that it increases our ability to produce food. We will not be able to produce enough food to feed the world in the foreseeable future, and GMOs alter products in ways that make them able to be grown in drier areas, in pest-ridden areas. They change the foods to make them more productive, and we need that.
Well, we have debated shows about debating GMOs. So let me get back to our callers here. We've got Dave from Maple Glen joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Dave. Go ahead. You're on the air. Do we have Dave? He says, on organic and other measures at Whole Foods, what's being missed is that small organic farmers do all the things that are sustainable. Whole Foods isn't giving them credit in their ratings. If they don't get this rating, it will hurt. And I guess this goes back to the better, best rating at Whole Foods. I guess this is a bit of an experiment that's been being played out to some degree.
I think it is. They even describe it as that. Right. As they respond to some of the complaints and criticism, Whole Foods says that this is a new program that we think is important. It is evolving. It will evolve, and we will change it to make it right over time.
Let me see what Susan from Ambler has to say. And Susan, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Yes, hi. I was just wondering, other than looking at expiration dates on fresh produce or looking at local versus organic, I always find it's a bit of a crapshoot in terms of just how fresh the produce actually tastes or how flavorful it tastes once you get it home. And then other than just going directly to a farm stand, are there any measures or other things that one can look for in terms of just when you get it home, you have a flavorful, fresh product?
And I assume we're talking, Susan, about fruits and veggies?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, how do you know, I guess, besides just the look test, if something
is... Right. A lot of times you get an organic product home and it never ripens, or you get something that goes from hard to rotten, or... you know, it looks fine when you pick it up in the food store, but it's just not so great once you get it home.
Well, Susan, let me see what Mark Lang has to say. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, that falls into the broader definition of culinary knowledge. And I think that when you, if you go to culinary school or you spend any time with a chef, one of their most important skills is their ability to evaluate quality before they start cooking and you see them making it. And I think cooking skills and food knowledge have been in decline in the U.S. for a long time. And I'm sure our grandmothers wouldn't have a problem deciding which tomato was the one that was going to be best a day from now. But there is the look, smell, thump test.
Yeah.
You know, those are things that are out there. But it comes down to finding a store that you have good experience with and that you trust is being careful with their produce supply system. There's another dimension that's lost in these modern times, and that's seasonality. Fruits have to be in or near season to have the characteristics that you're expecting. And if you're buying some fruit in the middle of February in Philadelphia.
Strawberries in February, right?
In Philadelphia, you should expect that it's not going to be like your ideal strawberry experience. And we have lost the sense of the seasonality of food.
Well, we're almost out of time here, but you mentioned sugar. And I guess if there is a culprit in our food supply, is sugar it?
My belief, my personal opinion is that it is the greatest issue that's going on here. Once we get past some of the issues of pesticides or chemicals that are clearly bad, I think that it's the sleeping giant behind most of the health problems and what's going on there. And I think that if we think organic or natural or GM, or we think of all these different characteristics, I think the realest and longest term idea is the idea of a clean label. It's the most defendable, and it's not a credence attribute. You can look at a label and see what ingredients are in it, and I think we should be much more conscious of how much sugar is in food.
Well, on that note, Mark Lang, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he's a professor of food marketing at the Hobbs School of Business at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. And coming up, Radio Times producer Debbie Bilder takes us to the fish counter at the supermarket. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. We've been talking about how to deconstruct food labels at the supermarket. Well, now we go to the fish counter where things have gotten more complicated, especially if you want to be a responsible eater. Radio Times producer Debbie Bilder spoke with Paul Greenberg, who has some easy rules for buying seafood. His most recent book is American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood.
Paul Greenberg, welcome to Radio Times.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Debbie.
I think a lot of us are bewildered looking at the fish counter these days. Why have things gotten so complicated?
Well, you know, there's very clear environmental signals coming from the ocean that business as usual really can't go on and that we have to start making choices that are in sync with certain environmental norms. And then, of course, there's also the prevalence of things like methylmercury, which is mostly caused by the burning of coal. So, you know, from a human health perspective, there's an issue. And from an environmental point of view, there's an issue. You know, on top of that, there's also this layer of environmental activism that I think can often create confusion for consumers. Many, many organizations out there would like to help you with your fish choices.
And these are the labels we see, things like first choice, I think I've seen, you know, second choice, things
right.
like that.
Probably the most common source of fish vetting is the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch program. Which is a really interesting program and a useful program. It does go through wild and farmed fish, species by species, sometimes stock by stock, and give either a best choice green rating or a good alternative yellow rating or avoid red ratings. But, you know, that shifts all the time. These things are dynamic, and so for the average consumers, it can be difficult to try and figure out if the fish right in front of them is worth eating.
Well, you've tried to help us with that by coming up with sort of easy rules we can follow. One of the first ones you write about is eat more American seafood. Tell me why we should be eating more fish caught in the United States.
Well, in the world, there are nations that are following the rules more or less, and then there are nations that aren't. And I thought it was useful at this juncture to kind of point out that the United States consistently ranks at the top of wild fisheries management. So it's not to say that the United States is the be-all and end-all of seafood, but we're very good, and we're at the top with this four or five other nations. And because of that, it's sort of a, you know, a cheat sheet. If you're buying seafood from the United States, it might not always be well managed, but chances are it has a better chance of being well managed than a lot of other places we're getting our seafood from.
So, and we're not eating enough American seafood, right? We import a lot of the fish we eat.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so it's kind of crazy when you look at the numbers. Around 90% of the seafood that Americans eat is imported. Just tons and tons and tons. But you would at first think, well, that's because, we must have, you know, caught all the fish and there's not enough fish in America to feed everybody. But when you dig down into the trade statistics, you find that the United States is actually exporting a lot of fish. We're exporting more than 3 billion pounds of seafood every year. That's about a third of what we catch. And it's kind of screwy. The seafood that we're exporting is generally wild. It's oftentimes species that people don't necessarily recognize. But then, meanwhile, the seafood that we're importing is often farmed. A lot of it is shrimp or tilapia or tuna, and a lot of it is coming to us from Asia. So I think there is a lot of American fish out there that Americans could be eating, but instead we're exporting it.
And there's this other sort of crazy process that you've written about. I think you give the example of squid that's caught in California, shipped to China, comes back to California.
Yeah.
I mean, walk me through that process. How does that make sense? How is that cost effective?
Yeah, so a few different American seafoods, squid, right, you rightly identify as a big one, and also a lot of Alaska salmon goes through this process where the seafood in question, be it the squid or the salmon, it's caught in America, frozen at sea, sent to China or to Vietnam or to Thailand, defrosted, boned or filleted in the case of salmon, cut up into rings in the case of squid, refrozen and sent back to us double frozen. So you can actually be, say, for example, in Santa Barbara, California, having a nice plate of calamari being sitting on the bay, more or less within eyeshot of the boat that caught your calamari, but it's quite possible that that calamari took a 10,000-mile round trip to China before it actually got to your place.
That's incredible. And is it just there aren't processing plants in the United States? They're too expensive?
It's a few different factors. First of all, labor in East Asia is much cheaper, particularly Southeast Asia. Some people have said that it's like a factor of four cheaper, if not more. One squid processor that I got information from put the number at something like I think it was going to add another $1 to $2 per pound for squid if you were going to have it processed here in the United States, which personally I would pay myself. The other thing that's going on here is that to freeze something and send it across the ocean on a boat from a carbon perspective is actually not that costly. Once you bring pieces of seafood down to freezing, you can basically seal up the whole the hold, and it's not going to cost you a lot of energy to keep it frozen. And then, of course, sea transport as opposed to air freight or any other kind of travel is very carbon efficient. So, yeah, I guess you could make the argument that you're not using that much carbon by doing it. But at the same time, if you look at what's going on along the American coast, we've lost a lot of processing infrastructure all up and down the American coast. And this transshipping or this offshoring of labor in the seafood sector, I think, is contributing to the decline of the American fishing industry, at least the decline on a sort of working waterfront basis.
And China has had, in the past, some food safety problems.
Yes.
And I know, sometimes there have also been questions raised about fish mislabeling, that you think you're eating, cod, and you're really eating, grouper. But, are those issues, too, with if you're shipping it so far away and bringing it back?
Certainly, if you've got this kind of hub into which many different kinds of fish go in one side and come out processed the other side, who's doing the audit inside the factory to say what's what? Because it's not just, American fish going in there and coming out and coming back to us. Scottish cod often goes to Asia and comes back as processed fish sticks or fillets. I think there's really ample opportunity for swapping around. From a health perspective, it's funny, you hear about the E. coli spinach disasters or you hear about, ground beef issues. You don't hear too much in the way of seafood scandals coming out of Asia, but only about 2-3% of the seafood that comes into this country gets even a look from the FDA, and so there's a lot of unknown out there. We do know there have been instances of aquaculture facilities in Asia using a chemical called malachite green, which is a carcinogen. There is oftentimes antibiotic use going on in some of the aquaculture facilities in Asia that would not pass American standards. you know, the FDA claims they have a sort of data management process that allows them to pinpoint potential funky shipments. But still, again, less than 3% is getting a look from the FDA.
And I don't know if this is related, but, you know, I think a lot of people today don't know how to clean a fish, you know, don't know how to scale it. I mean, me included.
Shame on you people.
Yeah, or, you know, or don't want to. Is that part of this, why we're willing to, you know, ship fish off seas, you know, 1,200 miles and, eat frozen fish that's, you know, been twice frozen?
Well, certainly the American tradition of eating seafood nowadays, if you want to call it a tradition, is basically give me a boneless chunk of flesh. That's
right.
What I want, and that's what I know how to deal with. And, you know, even when you see skin-on fillets at Whole Foods, I know people bristle about the idea of, oh, I'm going to have to defrost it and actually take the skin off. Like everything that involves particularity in this world, it loses out to generalities. And I know how to clean fish. Most of the Europeans I know how to clean fish. And most Greeks, for example, don't trust fish unless they've seen it whole first, because only when you see a whole fish can you really truly judge how fresh it is and in what kind of condition it was before it hit the grill.
And what fish it was.
And what fish it was. Well, you know, far be it for me to demand what fish it was.
Well, let me get back to your other rules that you've come up with. Your second rule is to eat greater variety of seafood. So I guess, first off, what are Americans eating the most? What fish do we eat most
of? Yeah, so the top three, which pretty much occupies 50% or more of what Americans eat, are shrimp, tuna, and salmon, and sometimes tuna and salmon trade places. So the shrimp, 90% imported, mostly coming to us from farms, oftentimes from Southeast Asia. Number two is, let's say, for now, canned tuna, and canned tuna, again, mostly imported. So, and then number three is salmon, and while I've said before, we do have quite a bit of wild salmon in this country. We export about 80% of what we catch here in this country. Meanwhile, two-thirds of what Americans eat in the salmon category is farmed and coming to us largely from abroad, oftentimes from Chile, which is not even a place that has native salmon.
Is it the taste? Is that why we're buying so much shrimp and tuna? Is it the price?
Well, there's the price is part of it. Certainly with the advent of farmed salmon, the price of salmon has come way down. You know, shrimp farming has brought shrimp way down, and tuna, you know, is a commodity that, you know, there are vast swaths of the ocean that are fished for tuna, and they can do it in a cost-effective way. So price is certainly a part of it. But I also think that Americans, all people, but Americans in particular, circle around known brands. And in the seafood world, there aren't a lot of brands out there. There aren't a lot of, you know, products that you could say, well, I know exactly how that's going to taste. That said, you look at a bag full of frozen shrimp, you kind of know how it's going to taste. You look at a can of tuna, you're like, ah, I know what I'm going to do with that. Or a piece of frozen salmon, you know, I can throw that on the grill. I know what it's going to do. So the surprise factor in seafood is a big problem for Americans, especially since seafood nowadays is so expensive. So to risk a bunch of money on a piece of fish that you don't know what to do with or how it's going to come out is a disincentive for Americans to try other things.
So your final rule that you suggest we follow is to eat more farmed filter feeders, things like oysters and mussels. Why should we be buying those?
Well, from an ecological point of view, they just make a lot of sense. You know, in this country, we don't do a lot of farming of marine animals, or, you know, aquaculture, as it's called. In the world, we rank about 15th. We're really not doing our part to try and grow a farmed seafood sector. One of the reasons we don't do it is because there's a lot of environmental objections to fish farming, and particularly with the salmon sector. It can often take more pounds of wild fish to grow a single pound of farmed salmon. So it can be a net loss of marine life. And a lot of people are saying, well, why should we do that, especially when you have something like a mussel or an oyster? So mussels and oysters don't need to be fed anything. The way that they live is, and the way that they grow, is by filtering out a microscopic phytoplankton from the water column, and they turn that into, you know, very delicious edible flesh. And in the case of mussels, they produce flesh that is as high in omega-3s as many varieties of canned tuna, with none of the mercury. So that's a very strong argument for those two kinds of things. The other sort of, it's not quite a filter feeder, but the other thing I throw out there is something we should develop are things like kelp and other marine vegetables. You know, we've all been following the water crisis in California, and we all know that we're coming to the limits of terrestrial agriculture. And as I say, they're not filter feeders. They require photosynthesis to grow, but they do the same thing that mussels and oysters do in that they extract excess nitrates from the water column. And this is a huge problem. These are the things that cause dead zones, and they're caused by sewage treatment plants and agricultural runoff. But if we actually were to farm in the sea in a responsible way, we could actually remove nitrates from the sea that are causing all sorts of bad things like dead zones.
And you mentioned farming salmon, and I remember hearing that, you know, farmed fish weren't good. They could escape and potentially spread diseases to wild populations. There was high use of antibiotics in farmed fish. Is that still the case, or has aquaculture cleaned up its act a lot? And are these, you know, when you go to the grocery store and look at things like farmed versus wild, should you be buying more farmed fish?
You know, aquaculture is really improving, particularly in countries that care about these sorts of things. If you just look at salmon, for example, I mentioned earlier that it can take more pounds of wild fish to grow a single pound of salmon. Well, the amount of fish in meal for salmon is gone down remarkably. I think it's gone down at least 50%, if not more, in the last 10 years.
There's another sort of movement, I guess, among fisheries, and it's a sort of CSF's community-supported fisheries, sort of like the CSAs some people belong to that, you know, you get a share of a farm's produce usually during the summer months. Is that taking off? Are people sort of joining those? Are fishermen and fisherwomen going directly to the consumer?
There is, you know, a local seafood movement in this country. I can safely say before I started my book, American Catch, I wouldn't say that there was. Every time I looked, there was another community-supported fishery appearing. But it's also important to remember what are the things that are causing this local seafood movement. Seafood is one of the most traded commodities on the planet. And as, you know, we were talking about earlier with, you know, squid and salmon, they could end up going to China for processing before coming back. With the advent of technology, with the advent of producers being able to find consumers more easily, hopefully we can cut out all the many, many rungs between the fishermen and the consumer so that, you know, the fisherman would get a better price and the consumer would get a better catch.
We've been talking, you know, about seafood and what we should buy and eat. It's summertime. And do you have some favorite summer seafood dishes or fish you love to grill that you could share with us before we go?
Well, on the East Coast, I'm a big fan of a fish called the Atlantic porgy, also called the scup in New England. I believe you have them down there in Philadelphia. It's a really nice fish. What's funny about this fish is that about 10 years ago, or maybe 15 years ago, you started to see in the markets everywhere this fish called a dorade or an orata, and it was, you know, usually you'd see it in a white tablecloth restaurant. It was like $25. Well, that's a very similar fish to an American porgy, only it's farmed and it's coming from Europe. So anything, you know, you might have considered with a dorade, you can do to an American porgy. And the great thing is that a whole porgy really usually sells for a couple bucks a pound. It's really, really a great deal. So with those, you just scale them up. Make sure you get all the scales off. I like to coat them in a mixture of breadcrumbs, olive oil, and rosemary and garlic and lemon. Let them steep in the breadcrumbs, and then you put it on the grill really hot and turn it over, and what happens is the skin fuses with the breadcrumbs, the rosemary, and the olive oil, and the lemon, and it makes this delicious, lovely crust, and it's a great summer meal.
That sounds delicious. Paul Greenberg, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Debbie.
Paul Greenberg writes about seafood and the oceans. He's the author of Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food, and most recently, American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. I'm Debbie Bilder.
And for more information about Radio Times, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, listen on satellite radio, and you can get our weekly newsletter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, Claire Moran, our summer intern, Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens produce Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.